Gospel this week is Luke chapter 12, verses 13 to 21. It would do us no harm at all also to read verses 22 to 34, which are left out of the lectionary. But starting at verse 13, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Friend, who set me to be a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Then he told them a parable. The land of a rich man produced abundantly. And he thought to himself, "What should I do, for I have no place to store my crops?" Then he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life,'" and the Greek word is soul, "'is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich towards God." Last week, one of my colleagues characterized the lie of the serpent as, "You will be like God," when we already are like God. The essence of idolatry lies in this misplaced adoration, which is really a rivalry with God and is deadly. The worst thing about possessions is that they can help us imagine we are like God in the wrong sense. They let us think we have a hedge against contingency, that we can buy our way out of being, in the end, a creature which is utterly dependent upon God by the second. Possessions are too easily our sign to ourselves that really we are God. The thing about a second-by-second dependence upon God is that it's our natural state. It is the way we are made. God's ordering of probabilities and somewhat unpredictable biological processes creates and sustains us, even though we would prefer a life chiseled out of certainty. The last thing we want to consider in our rivalry with God is that perhaps our natural state is good for us, that perhaps there is a sense in which needing to dodge bears and pick our way around the edges of steep hills orients us towards a kingdom life, both as individuals and as a culture. We who are so rich that we need to build our barns many stories high have, by contrast, chosen to shoot the bears on sight and cut a concrete motorway straight over the hills as though we owned the place, as though these blessings of life were a fault needing to be overcome. Of course, such an insight can be distorted into a romanticism which is its own avoidance of reality. What about bacteria and infant death we snap at the anti-vaxxers who somehow fail to realize that half of them would, like me, be dead if it had not been for Jonas Salk and Alexander Fleming? But where do we draw the line? How long do we keep people alive? And to what purpose? As we argue across the bed of the dying, the serpent's lie that we would be like God, knowing good and evil, is laid out before us. We barely know how to distinguish between them. Which means that even when we flee into the wilderness for a long weekend because we have begun to realize that all the larger barns and skyscrapers we have built threaten to destroy us, we take generators and satellite dishes and portable showers and floodlights, so that on the side of a mountain somewhere, as our lights wash out any sense of dependency and the music blares, God may not be heard to ask, "What are you doing here?" My dad gave me his old pop-top camper van. It saved me buying a car or spending a small fortune on taxis while I worked out if I could make a living as an IT consultant. We once squeezed ourselves into it for a short holiday and found ourselves allocated the space next to a top-of-the-line four-wheel drive with an enormous caravan. This rig was worth more than our entire house had cost to build. As we went exploring each day of our week off, the owner washed the unmoved four-wheel drive again, and then mopped and polished it dry in an almost liturgical routine. His wife spent most of the time in the van. Although full, something about that barn seemed desperately empty. Jesus said, "Take care, be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." All kinds of greed. I realized very quickly that paying attention to the statistics Google Analytics provided when I was paid to write a website was as deadly as loving a big four-wheel drive. Rather like measuring the worth of a ministry by the metric of bums on seats, actually. This very night, your life is being demanded of you, and this website you have idolized, whose will it be? Status is one more hedge against owning our smallness. It whispers to us that even if we cannot be like God, we can at least stand worthy among our companions, which is to know, really, that we can be better than them, despite all God's whispered questions about what we are doing here. I noticed in theological college that there were two kinds of books. There were those which I read and sought to remember in the way I'd once tried to retain the characteristics of various classes of herbicide. And then there were books which were rich and enthralling. I began to realize this was not only because they dealt with issues which interested me, but also because they were nearly always books written from places lacking privilege in the established church and in society. Privilege is a more dangerously potent form of possessions. Privilege means our possessions are uncontested. Privilege can mean we end up being blind and utterly merciless in our abundance as we look down upon those who do not have enough to live. I found that rich theologies were less privileged, and that changed everything they saw. What does it mean to be rich towards God? The text and its context suggests that we cannot store up riches and also be rich towards God. Acquisition was by its nature understood as stealing. The ancient Mediterranean attitude was that every rich person is either unjust or the heir of an unjust person. Molina and Rohrbach, in their social science commentary on the Synoptic Gospels, take Jerome as the source of that quotation. To be rich towards God is to recognize that we are already like God, made in God's image. We can plan, build, create, and rejoice, but do all this knowing that the creation is already very good. We can live knowing that God is for us, not against us, and that when God said, "It is very good," this included us. We are loved already. And we, more than all animals, can consciously seek to live and rejoice in a life where we know that we are a symbiont, and that it is in this harmony that we will find joy and fulfillment. We do not need to live as a parasite upon the planet. Look those words up at the end of this post, and I'll explain them then anyway. for those who are listening. So this would be to learn that the world is already subdued, is already good, and then our stewardship is to live with, not over. To live as biological beings, not as immortals independent of the Creator. All this means that we are made to die. Whether we are like Elijah, who was zealous for the Lord and have fled the consequences, whether we are comfortable at home, but with our faces carefully averted to avoid seeing our own discomfort and dissatisfaction, and even if we are truly possessed of a measure of peace, there will be a day when we are asked, "What are you doing here?" Our present life means we have to do a sort of psychological trick where we say, "A thousand may fall at my side, but it will not come near me." I'm quoting Psalm 91, verse 7, more or less. We have to do that simply in order to survive. So I'm cautious about making statements about death. Not only can we not speak from personal experience, but our motivations are always suspect. Yet, even as I am more keenly aware of the evolutionary pressures which secrete terror into my body when mortal risk comes near, and although I mourn the physical decline of my body, it seems that as we learn at last how good life is, we are then called to let it go. Despite all this, there is also something else. Sometimes I see what seems to be an extra kind of grace, or a special richness, given to the life of families preparing for bereavement. I asked a person about this once and received an emphatic yes as an answer. I've seen in some folk, who are the kind of no-bullshit blokes who never pretended piety for their minister, a sort of fierce joy as death came very close. The phrase, "preparing for the ride of their lives," came to mind. Could it be that when the Lord comes and asks, "What are you doing here, Andrew?" that I might be able to say, "Coming home at last," and able to say that with joy. As we say, time will tell. I'm much less hesitant about this, holding my undoubted privilege lightly, and seeking to use it for others rather than storing it up for myself, has been life-changing. Privileging possessions is to buy one's way into slavery. Despite all my fears about how I will live in the future, whenever I seek an answer in possessions, I find I have no answers for anything. May peace be upon you. The definitions. A symbiont is an organism living in partnership, living in symbiosis. Bees and flowers have a symbiotic relationship. A symbiont is especially the smaller member of a symbiotic pair. And as people, we've kind of forgotten that we are small partners in the living together of Earth. On the other hand, a parasite describes a being which is also in an intimate association between organisms of two or more kinds. But it's especially one in which a parasite obtains benefits from a host which it usually injures. And that says something about us as an animal on this planet too.